Welcome to the History Vault. Linda and Kathy from the Queens County Museum are here today, and they've just got over a big weekend with the Paranormal Conference, and from what I understand, they had a great turnout, and turned out to be a great weekend.
It was absolutely amazing, Dan. We had a good time.
It was.
The people had a good time.
We're all geared to start planning East Coast Paracon 2017.
Okay, well, that's great. I'm glad it all worked out. And today we're going to talk about the artifacts at the Queens County Museum. Linda explained to me off air that one of the important things about an artifact is the provenance of it. So we're going to talk about those today. And we're going to start off with something called the quilt code. And maybe, Linda, you want to tell me. I have no idea what a quilt code is. So,
Well, the quilt code isn't an artifact, but it's a story that goes along with an artifact. So we were donated a couple of years ago. I'm not sure just what year the book, the miniseries, The Book of Negroes came out. 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
That was, I think, 2 years ago.
Well, anyhow, we were fortunate to be given a number of the costumes that were left over from The Book of Negroes after filming was finished. And that came to us via Gail Hamlin. And we put those costumes, we mixed in with the interpretation of the Perkins House because of the colonial black history that that house has. Anyhow, so that's the artifact. The artifact was the donation of those costumes from the Book of Negroes miniseries, and they really had a story to tell. It doesn't matter that they're reproduction clothing. The fact is they told the story based on the Book of Negroes, which the Book of Negroes is a listing of all of the black loyalists who came up in 1783 and found their way to Nova Scotia. Now, the quilt code is an exhibit that we did a number of years ago. It was a story that first came out that was related to slavery and slavery in the United States. And at the time when ex-slaves were trying to make their way to Canada, there was a story or a legend or folklore, whatever you would call it, but it was all secret, that these slaves had a code amongst them using quilts. And the women would make the quilts, and of course we all know that quilts have different patterns and such, and they would put different quilt blocks into the quilt, and each pattern would stand for something. The basket pattern would be telling you fill your baskets because you're about to go on a journey. The bear claw would mean to them follow the path in the forest that the bear would take. There's probably 12 to 15 different quilt patterns that would have a code put to them that would tell them a story and lead them on their way to the north to Canada. That's when we first learned about the quilt code. We did an exhibit at the Queens County Museum in amongst our little black history display, and after a number of years we took it down, but then two of our summer students, they really took an interest in it, and they wanted to bring it back, especially where we had the costumes from the miniseries. And so they worked on it for a couple of weeks, and wow, they came up with an awesome exhibit at the museum of all about the quilt code and the Book of Negroes and the costumes all intertwined into a really beautiful display. So it would be, you know, nice for people to come down and have a look at it and learn the story, whether it's true or not, about the quilt code. We always say stories start somewhere, and so who knows. But the artifact in that story are the costumes.
And they're quite a collection of costumes from what I understand.
Oh, yeah.
I heard that Gail got a phone call that said that
she did.
She could go down and get them, and she, I guess, jumped right in her car.
She did, and her van was full to the top, and she called us right away, and we went up, and she gave us a good number of the costumes that she felt would be very good to work into the interpretation of Perkins House. And then I think she gave some more to Winds of Change or Astor Theater.
Yeah, I think the Winds of Change has some.
Yeah.
I remember it happening. I remember being in Lunenburg back when they were filming the Book of Negroes, and we had some company from Vancouver. We had them down there, and we actually got to see part of the filming, and that was kind of...
Oh, did you?
For people that were from the West Coast, they were they were quite impressed. And one of the actors was coming out to, I guess, on a break, and he came out and stopped and spoke to us and told us a little bit about what they were doing. And so it was quite an interesting afternoon.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yeah.
But we got to move on, and we're going to talk now about a fellow that I've heard about. I've heard his name. I think he was known as the Reverend John Passant. He was a congregational minister, I think. Was he
Methodist.
A Methodist? He was a Methodist. I thought he was a little bit too straight-laced to be a Methodist. Kathy, why don't you tell us the story of... I know in the Zion United Church there's a picture of the Reverend John Passant hanging on the wall, and he looks like a pretty dour man from his time.
Well, you shouldn't hold his image against him. You have to understand we actually are very fortunate to have a portrait of him done probably around 1810-ish, going from the look of it's very primitive style. It's not a beautiful portrait like you think of, like the Gorms or something. But it's and he looks very, very stern, and his lips are turned down, and he just looks like you
cranky
old thing. Come to find out, the poor man had false teeth, and as our listeners will know, false teeth is not super comfortable even today. Back then, they were carved out of wood, and there was no polygrip, so you had to keep your mouth clamped together, or your teeth would fly out.
Must have been hard when he was giving sermons.
I know. That's what I well, maybe.
Either that or they were darn short.
No, he was not known for his short sermons. He was known for speaking for hours because of his great love of God and going on. But the portrait is quite amazing because when you have a chance to look at it, besides an image of the man, you can see his life. Because many times in portraits, you can tell what, if you didn't know who the person was, didn't know anything about them, you look at the portrait and you can tell. And for instance, they have very many religious tracts in the background of this portrait. But John Passant came here probably in around 1780 as part of what they call the New Light Ministry. He followed a gentleman named Henry Allen, and they had a really strong belief of a personal relationship with the Lord. But I'm not going to get religious now. We're just going to talk about his life. And he basically stayed here in Liverpool until his death in 1834. And his family was brought up here and everything. But John Passant's amazing story was actually before he came to Liverpool. His mother and father, Louis Passant and Marie Ann Passant, had were given a grant of land in Mahone Bay, which is now, it was called Passant Island back then, but now it's called Covey's Island. And they had just set up shop, and Mr. Passant, dad, was going to sell goods, and they were just sort of getting their land straightened out, and they had things stored in the cabin. When this was during the French-Indian Wars of the 1750s, and a French-Indian raiding party came, and they killed a servant, a male servant, his wife, his child. And then they killed Mr. Passant's dad. And Mr. Passant honestly waited for his own death. But the natives found out that Mrs. Passant could speak French, and they thought maybe she was French and didn't want to hurt her. So they took John, a sister, and her, and they traveled by canoe, overland, as prisoners of the raiding party from Mahone Bay area up to Quebec City, where they stayed for 3 years until they were released at the end of the French-Indian Wars. So it's quite amazing to think that this man actually watched his father and friends of his father to be murdered in front of him, and yet he still followed the path he followed. But he's quite an amazing guy. The artifact came to us through the Dunlop family, because as well as his portrait, we have a chair which can be taken apart and carried on horseback. So wherever he went, he always had his comfy chair with him, which is quite
amazing
piece.
It was a folding chair.
Folding chair.
It's all hinged, and it's a big chair too, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
It's a big black leather chair, and it's all hinged, and you just fold it all up. We've never really tried it to see how it goes together, but just all folds up, and apparently he would strap it to his back when he was on his horse. And he even has a little footstool with it.
And little footstools. Mm.
Yeah, one of Nova Scotia's first moving companies.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, most preachers were itinerant at the time.
Well, that's the only way they made any money. That's the only way they could live, was they went from town to town raising money.
Yes.
But we're going to move on now. We're going to talk about a fellow that... a very popular fellow in the baseball world, and used to spend, I think, some time up in Nova Scotia when he was not playing ball. He came up here, I think, to hunt and fish, and that's none other than the great Babe Ruth of the New York Yankees. And I think the museum's got a school book of his. So, Linda, tell us about it.
Yeah, yes, we do. That's probably one of our most recent acquisitions. Just came to us last year. Mr. Granville Nickerson, who currently, he's from here, was a local boy from here, and he currently lives in Ontario, and Mr. Nickerson is in his early 90s, but when he was, I think he said around the age of 8, living here in Liverpool, Babe Ruth happened to come to town, and of course, you know, all the boys being baseball fans, Yankees fans, and Babe Ruth fans. And Granville Nickerson and his friend, whose name?
Mr. Surratt?
Mr. Surratt. were sitting right down here, well, on this site where we are at the radio station, in the old post office, the old Liverpool post office. They were sitting on the front stairs, and... Granville, they still had all of their school books with them. And all of a sudden, Babe Ruth and another gentleman is standing on the corner in front of Mr. Nickerson. And he recognizes Babe Ruth right away. And he says to his friend, "Wow, would I ever love to have Babe Ruth's autograph." And he got out one of his little school books, and he said, "I would really like to take my school book over and get the Babe to sign it, but I'm too shy." So his friend said, "Give it to me, I'll take it over." So he gave it to him. He took it over to Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth signed the inside cover of Granville's school book, and his friend brought it back, at the time, he took the pencil and his friend signed his own signature underneath Babe Ruth's signature, which Mr. Nickerson, to this day, regrets.
Has never forgiven him.
Has never forgiven him that he signed his name under Babe Ruth's signature. And Mr. Nickerson is in his early 90s now, but he has forever hung on to that book as a very special treasure in his life. But being in the age that he is now, he wanted that book to come back to his hometown of Liverpool and to the County Museum to be put on display so that other people could enjoy what he had many years of enjoyment looking at. And so we were very pleased to take the book and the story, and we had a special case built for it. And then a gentleman, we knew that there were some pictures that were floating around town that were taken at the time that Babe Ruth was in town, because I remember the late Hugh Byrne, telling us about them. And he had shown us a picture one time of Babe Ruth holding a child down at Fort Point, and Hugh said that that child was him, and he was probably maybe 2 or 3 at the time. And so we contacted Hugh's brother, who lives in the area, and his brother had the photographs, so he made us copies, and we've put some of those photographs in this little case that we had built especially for the book to go along with, you know, why Babe Ruth was in town. But it's as you say, Dan, Babe Ruth used to come up here on hunting and fishing trips. And he, at the time that he was in town on this day that he signed Granville's book, it was probably around 1933, and he was actually in Yarmouth. He was there on a hunting trip in Yarmouth, which he used to spend a lot of time up there with the guides. But on that particular year, the guide wanted to bring him down to Liverpool to do some hunting up Rosignol. And so that was the reason why he was in Liverpool during that particular time. But there's a whole story just about Babe Ruth and all of his hunting and fishing days here in Nova Scotia, in southwest Nova Scotia. Yeah, so that was a great artifact that has a great story.
And keep in mind, folks, back in the 1930s, it wasn't just as easy to get to here as would have been today. I mean, today you get on an airplane, you're here in an hour. And back then you must have come by boat or by train and boat or combinations.
And can you imagine even just the trip from Yarmouth to Liverpool? I mean, it's a two-hour drive for us, but it must have even been a while for the guide to get him down here.
Yeah, but think about this. Trains, club car, Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
Black rum.
Yeah.
I don't know where we're going with that one.
Yeah.
We're not going there.
Good poker game.
Exactly.
Lots of cigars.
Those were the days.
Yeah.
They were.
Yeah. Good story.
We got to move on. And another artifact that's down in the museum, and Kathy brought a picture of it to, she can't show it to you, but she did show it to me, was Sam Kempton bust. And Kathy, tell us, who was Sam Kempton? And this about?
Sam Kempton was a young lad from Milton who spent 20 years studying the ways of the sea, and he really, that was his life, and he went on to become a captain, and he also later in his life became part of the Milton Aerated Waterworks, or the pop factory that used to be up in Milton. So he was very busy in the town of Liverpool, and he was quite, you know, as all most of the Kempton family were very involved in Milton history. But the reason why we talk about him today is his bust. And it's a carved wooden bust. He looks very regal for a young fellow of about five. It depicts him at the age of five, and he's got a very stern face, and he's got his hand across his tummy, and the other one, we're not sure, because just like the Venus de Milo, one of his arms is missing. So it is quite an amazing piece made of soft wood, and the reason why it's one of my favorite pieces in the museum is it was carved by a gentleman named George Krause, and it actually is the only known surviving piece that this talented carver has left in the world. And George Krause was he used to do the figureheads on the bows of sailing ships. You remember, always see the little mermaid or the ladies or something on the bow of a sailing ship. Well, George was known for doing that, so of course a lot of his work would have been lost or destroyed over the years. So it's really amazing to have this particular piece left. As well as his bust, we also have his little clarinet, which is kind of fun to look at. And it's just absolutely amazing, and people just stare at it because it's not usual to have a bust of a child, pictures, portraits, but never to have a bust. So that's why it's one of our favorite pieces at the museum.
And that went to Sam. Mm-hmm. And one of our other artifacts went on a Great Britain tour, went on a folk art tour in the early 80s. It went to Ireland and England and different parts of... So that was quite a thing for Sam to be out of the country that long. It was actually our rocking horse that went with as well.
He's traveled more than I have.
He has, yeah.
Well, we got to move on, ladies, because we're... We're going to run out of time again today. I mean, we look at these questions. We got plenty of time in it. We're going to talk now, or Linda's going to talk about the Proprietor's Minute book and the Town of Liverpool book. And I guess they're on display down there, too?
Yeah. Now, you know, Dan, there you talk about two really important documents for the history of this county. And that's the Proprietor's Minute book, which starts in 1762. And, you know, with the when the founding fathers came in 1759 and got together, which one of them was Simeon Perkins, they had what they called the Proprietors Committee, and of course they had a minute book, and we have it. And the minute book, and also the other book, the Town of Liverpool book, and that's what I'll call it, but these are the two of the very first books that are even older than Perkins' Diary, because Perkins' Diary doesn't start until 1766. And these two contain the first real recorded history of our county and of our town. And so the Proprietor's Minutes, that minute book contains, you know, whatever was all going on that would have to do with the settling of the town, the development of Liverpool and the people within. And in that, if I don't know if everyone remembers before amalgamation and we were the town of Liverpool, Liverpool had its own town crest. And in that minute book, and actually we have it turned to the page, is the minutes of the meeting where that town crest was first
developed.
And they decided what was going to go on it, the fish, the water, the trees, because we were fisheries, we were forestry, and we were on the ocean. So that's a real piece of history right there. And Joan Bray, some years ago, she painted the town crest for us, and that hangs above the case where the Proprietor's Minute book is displayed, and that's right next to Perkins' Diary. And then the Town of Liverpool book was, again, this was started back in 1759 by our founding fathers. It contains all vital statistics of the people here, the land that was granted to the different settlers who came, the cattle marks. Each person was assigned a cattle mark to identify their cattle, and that's all in the book. That book was kept for, oh my goodness, well, I guess 200 years. The last place it was known, it was kept for many years, was out in the deeds office, out in the vault, in a huge copper
box.
And when they decided to microfilm all of the deeds books and kind of dismantle the deeds office and the deed books, send them all out for microfilming, the deeds office donated the copper box to us that contained that very important piece of history, that huge book, and we were just so thrilled to receive it. Now, that book is not out on display because it's been carefully wrapped in acid-free paper. It needs a little bit of conservation work because it's very fragile. It's huge, isn't
yes,
it, Kathy?
It is.
It is huge. But it's very fragile. We've had the public archives in Halifax take a look at it, and the conservator in there, who said they could easily fix it to, you know, bring it back to life, that we could display it properly. And at the same time, they would like to microfilm it when that's done. But yeah, so she sits there all wrapped up until such a time we can do something with it.
Interesting stories from the Queen's Paddy Museum. I mean, we've got about 2 minutes left, Kathy. If you we talked about this fellow before on the show. His name was Dr. Fault, and the instruments from Dr. Fault are at the museum. And Kathy, you got about 2 minutes to tell us about
it. No problem. I'll talk quickly, because I did talk a little bit about him actually last week about some of his instruments, because you had just actually gone through some surgery, and I was saying how lucky you were to have a local dentist and not Dr. Fault.
This is true.
But one of the pieces I didn't talk about was one of his surgical knives, which are there. They're folding surgical knives, so you carried it in your pocket, and if you needed to do a little operation, you just snap it open like a little jackknife.
Tortoise shell handles.
With tortoise shell. I mean, it was a classy, instrument, but we have two of them, which is quite amazing. We also have one of his medical books, which when you start reading about how they did things, for instance, inoculations for smallpox, as they took that lovely surgical knife and between your thumb and forefinger, cut a nice little slip, and then they would find the nearest cow with some cowpox, and they would cut open one of the pox and put a string through it and slap it in there and wrap it up, and hopefully you lived.
I think I might prefer medicine today.
So I really encourage people to come down to the museum and see.
Oh, they are great, those
I won't be quite so gross and gory, I promise.
The bleeding tools.
The bleeding tools and
the tooth pullers.
The dental clamps that look like something that came out of Dad's toolbox.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, I happened to be at a doctor the other day, and we were just talking about different things, and he said, you know, back in the day, he started the conversation, you know, back in the day, and then he paused and he said, I'm talking 15 years ago.
Well, so I got him beat.
So things continue to change. And,
thank
and
heavens.
All
thank for
God
the good.
For the good. Thank God for the good. But folks, get down to the Queens County Museum and see some of these great artifacts, and I know there's many, many more that we haven't talked about. So take some time, go down, see Linda and Kathy and the great volunteers down there, and I'm sure they'll be happy to take you through and show you all the stuff. And the Queens County Museum is a treasure that we're very lucky to have here. And just before we close off, Premier Stephen McNeil was in town, Linda, and he made a comment about renewing their commitment to open a Perkins House.
Yes, because he said he didn't come to Liverpool to talk about Perkins House. yes, he did, and that was good news to our board's ears, to ensure the people of Queens County and the people that live away but are formerly from the county that, you know, the progress is slow, but the commitment is there that they will put her back together and get her open again.
Well, that's good, and hopefully someday they'll be able to get the thing moving and moving fairly quickly rather than just let it sit on the back burner.
Yeah.
But anyway, that concludes the History Vault for another week. I'm Dan McLaren, Kathy and Linda. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And we'll see everybody again next week on QCCR.